From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Morgan Mendenhall, a student majoring in political science and journalism. She's working as an assistant producer with VOA's Press Conference USA while finishing her studies. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Cheryl Cashin, professor of law at Georgetown University and author of the recently published book, Loving: Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. The book's publication coincides with the 50th anniversary of Loving versus Virginia, the United States Supreme Court case decided in 1967, which overturned state laws banning marriage between whites and people of color. The so-called anti-miscegenation laws were designed to enforce racial segregation in the United States and deter intermingling of the races. In her book, Cashin says that Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, who wrote the unanimous Loving opinion, asserted that such laws were an instrument of white supremacy. The first time the Supreme Court used those words to describe what the Civil War and the 14th Amendment should have defeated. In Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy, Cashin explores both the history and the future of interracial intimacy and its impact on American politics and society. She advocates the concept of cultural dexterity, the capacity to see a racial other as a three-dimensional human being. We'll explore the concept of cultural dexterity, as well as the significance and implications of the Supreme Court decision on Loving versus the state of Virginia, among many other related issues in this edition of Press Conference USA. Professor Cashin is a former Clinton White House advisor on urban and economic policy and was a law clerk to the late U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American Supreme Court justice. Her parents were political activists, and she has written three other books on the subject of race. And Cheryl Cashin joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington to talk about her new book. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm very delighted to welcome my colleague, Morgan Mendenhall.
Thank you.
Well, Cheryl, first of all, congratulations on your terrific book.
Thank you so much.
It's very profound, and we'll find out more as we talk with you. First, however, discuss the significance and implications of this landmark Supreme Court decision of 50 years ago, Loving versus the state of Virginia, and talk to our listeners about the name Loving.
Okay, so starting with the name Loving, Richard Loving, that was his surname, fell in love with a mixed-race Black and Indigenous woman, Mildred Jeter. They lived in a rural hamlet of Central Point in Virginia, a farming community where Blacks, Indigenous people, and whites, struggling people, had been dealing with each other from colonial times. And there was a history of mixing in that town. Richard would hang out with Mildred's brothers. They listened to bluegrass music together, and he fell in love with her. And as people do when they fall in love, they had sex, and she got pregnant, and he wanted to do the honorable thing. He wanted to marry her. And they did not realize that there were these laws that had existed for 300 years in this country banning them. They married in Washington, D.C., came back to Virginia, were, you know, dragged out of their bed in the middle of the night by a sheriff and his deputies. And that was the beginning of their 9-year battle that ultimately results in this Supreme Court case, in which the court, as you said in the intro, got rid of the last plank in the regime of Jim Crow, formal regime of Jim Crow, named it and said, you know, this is about white supremacy. And yet today we still have evidence that the ideology undergirding these laws is still with us.
Indeed. Quick follow-up about the ideology or the thoughts undergirding, you know, these laws banning interracial marriage. You do argue in the book that these state laws banning interracial mixing and marriage were intended primarily as instruments of white supremacy, just as Earl Warren said in the decision, and that actually an economic argument underpinned these laws as well. You allude to the fact that poor whites and people of color actually had a lot of things in common with each other during those days of slavery and even in the post-Civil War era. and that the landed white classes just didn't want them to band together, get too friendly or intimate, lest they actually work together to press for better conditions and other rights.
Right. This is a central point of the book. If your listeners get nothing else, I want them to get this point. Whiteness in America was created to solve a class conflict between the elite planter class and the struggling whites. And the thing they most feared was that struggling whites, former indentured servants, and enslaved Black and Indigenous people would rebel together to demand more economically of elites. And so whiteness was created to divide them. And for the first 60, 70 years in the colonies, there was no concept of race. Indentured whites and enslaved Blacks and Indians worked alongside each other. They fraternized, they had sex, they got drunk together. And there were several rebellions in which they, you know, ran off together or rebelled. And so when the slave owning class wanted to transition to Black chattel slavery, they had this problem of white allies. And so what do? They create a color line. It's only when they're transitioning to Black chattel slavery that they begin to penalize interracial sex and interracial marriage. And the first laws against interracial marriage were part of Virginia's slavery code. And all the other slave states followed Virginia's example. That's in the 1600s. By the 1700s, you begin to get this emergence of white race pride, and that ideology and this political function, divide and conquer, continues to this day. Every time you have an assertion of whiteness, assertion of white supremacy, there's an economic story there. And the same regime, whether it's Jim Crow or voter suppression, that oppresses people of color, there's typically an economic story of struggling whites also being oppressed in different ways, but definitely being oppressed and often betrayed.
Well, that's just absolutely fascinating. I must give my colleague Morgan Mendenhall an opportunity to ask a question.
To follow up on the point that you mentioned, there was a brief time in American history where white supremacy wasn't the governing of race relations as we understand it to be. Mm-hmm. And we made that switch, as you just laid out. So why is that switch back to more unified everybody on a level playing ground proving so hard to be all these years later?
Well, first of all, it works, unfortunately. But we have a long history of dog whistling, the most modern iteration, you know, since the late 60s, after the Civil Rights Movement, starting with Richard Nixon. They figured out that they could stoke resentment among whites about the gains of blacks in order to get elected. And unfortunately, we've had this race-coded politics, and it continues to this day. And so, you know, what we have in the United States today is a conflict of worldviews. It's not between racists and non-racists. I call it between culturally dexterous people who accept the idea that whites will be just one voice among many in a robust democracy, pluralism, right? Cultural pluralism. And people who grew up expecting whites to be dominant, these are the non-dexterous folks, and have not yet been able to accept the loss of centrality of whiteness, right? And so candidate Trump, he's just the latest iteration of it. He's not the only person who's done this, but he was able to play on people's fears, you know, anti-immigrant, casting Latinos as rapists. I don't think Trump himself is a white supremacist, but winking to those who are supremacist. And, you know, he's able to play on people's fears. There's a fascinating piece in the March issue of The Nation by two political analysts, which found that the central explanation behind Trump's support was if people registered fear about growing diversity in this country, they were more likely to ally with Trump. And so that's why it's been very difficult.
Well, that's very interesting. I want to pick up on that very briefly, because some people might say, well, this is not really a zero-sum game. Those people who are fearful of, as you call it, cultural dexterity or diversity, as we're seeing in this country, we're becoming a predominantly minority-populated country. The demographics are going away from the WASP culture, the white Anglo-Saxon, and we're seeing more people of color, Latinos, African-Americans becoming the majority. But one could argue that, well, as a result of opening up the society, we're not taking away from those who feel, though, that they are being deprived, maybe white people who fear this cultural diversity. Why is it, do you think, that they see the opening up, whether it's to gay marriage or interracial marriage, and seeing lots of diversity in this country, why do they see this somehow as a zero-sum game?
Well, I think for a certain type of person, and one of the things I'm very careful about is not speaking about whites in monolithic terms. Right? There are dexterous and non-dexterous whites. There are dexterous and non-dexterous blacks. But the person who has not yet acquired dexterity is used to being central. I mean, there's studies that show that even seeing a Star Wars movie where Finn, a black character, plays a central role as a trooper, stormtrooper, I believe, people see that and get a knee-jerk reaction like, you know, like that's not supposed to be happening. You're almost angry sometimes. If you experience that, it's you haven't accepted that there are all kinds of people and there's no reason, and it was artificially constructed in the first place of making whites politically dominant and culturally dominant. It took a whole phalanx of laws, including anti-miscegenation, to create that. Well, dexterity is the opposite of colorblindness. It's actually seeing racial and ethnic difference and liking it, maybe even falling in love with it, but accepting that there are other cultures out there that I might learn something from and not perceiving that as a threat to me and my own identity. It's something beautiful to be celebrated. And that's just a very different mindset. And frankly, older whites are the folks that seem to have a harder time with the loss of centrality to whiteness because they grew up in America where whites were dominant. So you sometimes hear people say, I don't recognize this country anymore, you know.
Exactly. And yet we are seeing, I guess one could call it somewhat of a resurgence of white supremacy, and we're seeing younger people involved in that. But we'll get to that in just a moment. First, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Cheryl Cashin, author of Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA assistant producer and student Morgan Mendenhall. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Syed Mojtaba Javadi. He's a loyal listener from Kabul, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'd also like to know what you think of VOA's Press Conference USA. We'd appreciate it if you could take a brief online survey. You can find the survey on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Carol Castiel. Now, let me turn to my colleague, Morgan Mendenhall, for another question.
Going off your example of Finn in Star Wars, the media representation landscape has been a hot-button issue that this generation has picked up. And you talked about how informing cognitive connections with people, whether they be fictional or real, that increases the cultural dexterity of individuals. Could you just elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yes, thank you for that question. So in the book, I talk about five forms of intimacy that enable you to acquire dexterity: marriage and cohabitation, dating, transracial adoption, friendship, and there's this fifth form, is virtual. And social science has shown that people have the capacity to develop affectionate ties to a fictional character or, say, a black president of the United States just by watching them in a way that humanizes that person's race for them. And it's been shown that people who develop these ties actually can experience a reduction in racism, the same kind of effects that having an intimate friendship with a person of another race can show. And I saw all this social science. And people with a black friend, for example, recent research has shown that they're more likely to empathize with what black people experience, and they're more likely to get angry with what they learn, and they're more likely to engage in collective action to fight for social change. And so this concept of cultural dexterity and spreading interracial intimacy, which I document in the book, makes me hopeful that we may reach a point, and this is what I think happened in California, where a critical mass of whites, not all whites, but a critical mass of white Americans empathizes with people of color and wants to be part of a robust multiracial coalition that fights for the common good.
But Cheryl Cashin, you are relatively optimistic in your vision. And I want to press you on that because what we're seeing in recent days, we're seeing, for example, hangman's rope, nooses are cropping up. We see them on U.S. campuses in the new Museum of African American History and Culture, death threats to the curator himself. And of course, we know that nooses are a powerful symbol of bigotry and hatred directed at African Americans over history. They symbolize lynching of black people. So this is very disturbing, I think, for everyone here in America and overseas to see this. Why do you think we're seeing a resurgence of these symbols, of these hateful symbols recently?
Okay, so this attests to the enduring ideology, right? We create this ideology of white supremacy and we propagate it over the centuries. I tell that story. I also want to emphasize that there have always been ardent integrators and some culturally dexterous people who fought alongside people of color. But the ideology is there. And I actually think that the person who leaves a noose at the Museum of African American History and Culture, it's a low-tech, cheap, easy thing to do that gets a lot of attention. And there are far more people who are open-minded than there are avowed supremacists. I actually think supremacists are a very tiny minority in this country, but they perceive this change in culture, and I think this is the last gasp of them desperately trying to fight it by, you know, throwing around these symbols.
Well, that's a very good point. As you say, that's what I was thinking, perhaps the last gasp. And as in any movement, the minority voices who are perhaps one could characterize them as backwards or retrograde, they're the loudest. They shout the loudest.
Right.
Sometimes we hear them and they get the press.
Right.
It's true. And Lonnie Bunch, the curator of the museum, wrote an opinion editorial in the New York Times talking about, you know, that similarly to what you just said, that it's a hateful thing, but the resilience of black people throughout history will certainly overcome these types of actions.
So we've been in this dance from the founding of this country, right? You have the beautiful words of Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, egalitarian values. And then you have the ugly words of Thomas Jefferson in Notes on Virginia, in which he all but justifies slavery by talking about the inferiority of people. That's in the same person, right? And that personifies incongruity, but we had people fighting for the universal egalitarian values for the beginning. And I believe that group is growing rapidly and they're beginning to win out, but you always have a backlash. And so each generation has to enter this fight.
Well, that's a very good point. And before I turn back to Morgan, your personal story is, of course, a very inspiring one. Talk very briefly, because your parents were activists, and talk about how they perhaps inspired you in your career.
Right. I was born and raised in Huntsville, Alabama, the child of activists. My mother took me to a sit-in in Huntsville, Alabama, when they were trying to desegregate public accommodations. I was 4 months old. My mother got herself arrested with me in my arms. Huntsville was not violent like Birmingham, but that was a turning point in Huntsville's sit-in movement. And it goes on from there. My father founded an independent Democratic Party at a time when the regular party was dominated by George Wallace, and he ran for governor against George Wallace.
And of course, George Wallace was the ultimate
white supremacist.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, 1967, he founds this party the same year Loving's decided. But what's interesting, my parents, they recruited liberal Unitarians, white Unitarians, to join their movement to show Alabama that, you know, there was a different way of being. The political party, NDPA, was a biracial party. Liberal whites who resented the racist image of the state. And so, you know, I grew up in an environment around people of color and white folks who really believed in the idea that was represented in Reconstruction in this country, that you could have a biracial, multiracial democracy that does things like creates public education for the first time, that works for struggling people of all kinds. You know, and I think California and other states in this country that are robustly diverse represent that as well. And that's what gives me hope about the direction of this country.
Morgan.
We've talked a lot about how polarized everything is just over this whole past couple months. And in the last chapter of your book, you suggest that the culturally dexterous will restore functionality to politics.
Right.
Can you explain how you see this happening in the future and what form this takes?
Right. So I'm not naive. I do not claim that interracial intimacy alone is going to save us. It's a confluence of forces. The rapid growth of people experiencing intimacy and knowledge, gaining knowledge about the experiences of others, combined with the dying off of an older generation that grew up expecting to be dominant, combined with rapidly growing Latino and Asian populations that are getting much more, and Muslim population, getting much more engaged in politics, and all of these things together will enhance possibilities for what they call a coalition of the ascendant, a majority multiracial population that accepts the loss of centrality of whiteness and wants to create a coalition for the common good.
Well, back to the moment we're living in right now, Cheryl, do you think we're in a moment where people actually feel that they have permission, in a sense, to be hateful? You know, as I said, we are seeing, notwithstanding mm-hmm. the larger vision that you have and the reasons for that, we are seeing a resurgence of white supremacy. We see the Ku Klux Klan coming out again on the streets in demonstrations. The so-called, we call it the alt-right, but mm-hmm. it's just sort of a euphemism for white supremacists. As I said, we're seeing signs that they're coming out in force. Do you think there's a, as I said, sort of an environment of a permission for this?
Well, I think that there are a lot of people who are disturbed by this. And I say this in the book, this is a time of choosing, right? If anything, the most recent election and this reassertion of very old dogmas should make it clear to folks that, you know, you got to choose, you know, and you got to fight for the country you want. But I think this is making people be more engaged in politics and resistance and saying, I reject that. That is un-American. I think of this reassertions of supremacy and these symbols and rhetoric, it's a recruiting tool. I analogize it to the same kind of ideology and rhetoric that people use to bring people to terrorism. And they're a tiny minority. Everybody else has to be very clear about what they stand for and engage with politics. Find your allies.
Well, that's a very good point. And it harks back to the days, I guess, of George Wallace as well. I mean, he and others, white supremacists, also were appealing to the worst instincts of some of their constituents.
Right. There's no question that right now is a terrible time in terms of, I do think there are people who feel there's permission to say things out loud that they otherwise would not have said. And, you know, what happened in the civil rights movement in the United States is that enough people stood up, a lot of Northerners and elsewhere, and moderate Republicans changed their minds when they saw those awful images of children being hosed in Birmingham. But yeah, I want to underscore to your listeners that I feature throughout the book beautiful stories of alliance and love. You know, and this is also something that gives me hope, right? You know, some of my favorite characters, I call them ardent integrators, allies, some of my favorite characters in the book, Thaddeus Stevens, who was a radical Republican, the author, one of the authors of the 14th Amendment, Frederick Douglass, who's, I think, pretty well known internationally. But, you know, these are people who are radical in their politics, committed to egalitarianism, and also were radical in terms of freeing themselves to love across lines. And we've had a long history of alliance that is lesser known. And, you know, I think the supremacists of this country, there's no way they're going to win out over the, you know, if you look at millennials, Morgan, your generation gives me a lot of hope. I mean, I think people malign your generation a lot. But, you know, people may point out that Dylann Roof, the awful guy who spouted this rhetoric and shot 9 people in church. I want to point out that 60% of millennials, people under 30, agree with the Black Lives Matter movement and their critique of law enforcement, right? I think we may already have a critical mass of allies who, you know, support the kind of robust multiracial politics that Obama's election represents. But we still have some of the enduring structures, gerrymandering, you know.
Gerrymandering, of course, that means the designing of the electoral districts such that they produce a particular outcome.
Right, but basically racial and partisan gerrymandering has created a Congress that is much more extreme than the popular will. We can't get a lot of things done that there's a overwhelmingly majority popular support for because the people in Congress represent extremes. So I actually think we already have a critical mass, right? You see this in the popular majority supported Hillary Clinton. The popular majority supports the climate accords. The popular majority supports common sense gun control. Another thing that gives me hope in this country is that we have, you know, a recent Supreme Court opinion that struck down racial gerrymandering in North Carolina. Next year, we have a very critical Supreme Court case involving partisan gerrymandering. You know, one of the things that happened in California went from majority white to majority minority and from gridlock to functional in part because they got rid of gerrymandering in that state. And so, you know, they put districting in the hands of a citizens commission. And so politics returned to being functional in that state. And so my hope is that that's what's going to happen in the next 10, 15, certainly 20 years in this country.
Let me turn to my colleague Morgan Mendenhall, who is a millennial. Mm-hmm. Do you share Cheryl's optimism about your particular age group? And I mean, are you relatively optimistic about the future?
I do. I think a point you brought up in the book is having honest conversations about race. And I've done that with a whole lot of my friends. They ask me questions like, what does the Black Lives Matter movement actually mean? Like, I don't disagree with those three words, but have me explain them to them. And they are very open to ideas that sometimes I thought they wouldn't be, and we're able to see eye to eye on a lot more things than we critique the Congress left and right, because some things that should go through without an issue are stuck and we're lost as to how that happens. But that's a good point to bring up about gerrymandering.
Right. So, of course, this is an argument for civic
engagement.
Action and engagement.
Right. And my message, particularly in the last chapter of the book, is you can't just sit on the sidelines and wait for demographic and attitudinal change to come. You have to get in there. You have to register to vote. You run for office, find your allies. There are a lot of organizations out there involved in movements, and it is a time of movements. You know, it's also a time of clashing worldviews. I think the worldview of universal human dignity is going to win out in this country.
The book is Loving, Interracial Intimacy in America and the Threat to White Supremacy, and it was written on the 50th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision Loving versus the State of Virginia, and of course referring to the plaintiffs, Richard and Mildred Loving. He was white, she was black, they couldn't legally marry in the state of Virginia, and this decision struck that law down. And the author is Cheryl Cashin. She's a law professor at Georgetown University. Cheryl, it was a delight to talk with you. Thanks so much for coming in and sharing your insights about your new book.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. Joining me on the program was VOA assistant producer Morgan Mendenhall. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.